This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. If you are 65 or older, or have two or more underlying health conditions, you're newly eligible today to receive a coronavirus vaccine in Massachusetts. But if you logged onto the state website to book an appointment this morning, you might have gotten an error message. That's what happened to 69-year-old Maureen Latenda of Marlborough.
I just don't understand. They had plenty of time to work on this prior to getting the vaccine. We knew for a long time it was coming, and I just don't get it.
66-year-old Steve Samler of Andover also couldn't get the site to work.
Everybody else I talked to in the country who's 65 and older has already seemed to have gotten appointments, you know, and shots, or both. You know, we seem to be very well behind the eight ball here in Massachusetts.
Just after 11 this morning, the state's official Twitter account posted a notice that all appointments at the mass vaccination sites in Springfield, Danvers, Natick, and Dartmouth had been booked up and apologized for the, quote, website challenges. State officials say they're trying to work out the technical issues now, so as we wait, we're left asking, what happened? Here to help us figure it out is WBUR Common Health reporter Angus Chen. Angus, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, Callum, thanks.
Also with us is Boston Globe tech columnist Hiawatha Bray. Hiawatha, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Did you try to sign up for a vaccine appointment on the state website today, or did somebody you know? And are you frustrated by another bump in this already rocky vaccine rollout? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Angus, let's just step back and help us understand why the state website was overloaded this morning. How many people became newly eligible for the vaccine today?
Well, we don't really know for sure because it's hard to know how many people in the state have those two comorbidities or more, but it's estimated to be about a million people when you include everyone who's over 65 or 65 to 75 and then those two comorbidities. So it's a sizable population.
And we heard a couple of frustrated folks right at the top. What else are we hearing about people's experiences trying to sign up for slots today? I mean, did anybody get through?
Some people did get through. I mean, of course, as we know from the state, a lot of appointments have just been completely taken up at different sites. But it wasn't easy for people to get those appointments. We had people writing in to us saying that they had been trying for 2 hours or more to get those appointments. You know, one person said that they had tried like 200 times to make an appointment before finally getting through. And then other people, you know, had tried just as hard and never were able to make an appointment today. So it's, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag when it comes to who got the appointments. But it seems to be universally the case for people today that it was a difficult experience.
I see. And we appreciate those of you who did write in with your experiences. And if you'd like to chime in now, again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Angus, this isn't the first problem with the state's website either, is it?
Yeah, it has been a little bit of a mess pretty much since the vaccine website's launched. One of the main problems since the beginning has just been that there are a lot of websites for people to navigate. So it's not super straightforward or easy to find where you can make those appointments, or it hasn't been. And at other times in the last couple of weeks, people have noticed that the websites have been slowing down. So state-sponsored websites would slow down at certain high traffic times, you know, maybe when a new site opens up and has a bunch of appointments available, then there's a little bit of a traffic jam, I guess. So it was, you know, we could sort of see some of these problems beginning to show their head even before today.
And Hiawatha, let me come to you because, you know, maybe we're just spoiled by technology that works well. I mean, is this harder than we're giving the state credit for? I mean, what is the technical side? What does it take, resources, computing power, to host a website that can handle tens of thousands of people trying to access it all at once?
Well, let's just say it shouldn't be as hard as it is now. This is stuff that is now handled routinely. I mean, remember, we used to work together at the Globe. Years and years ago, this used to be a huge deal when you suddenly opened up a website to this much traffic. But in the age of cloud computing, that simply should not be the case because you literally have computing power on command. You go to your cloud provider like an Amazon or a Google or any of these guys, and they just turn it up. They put you on as many servers as you need to have in order to handle whatever traffic you've got. And this kind of thing happens all the time, and other companies and government agencies handle it. I've talked to people about this, and they basically say they just weren't prepared. We don't know at what level they weren't prepared, partly because we still don't know exactly what went wrong. We don't know if it's a matter of there being too much traffic, or, for example, it could be a matter of a particular app that broke. Maybe the app can't handle that much traffic. The servers can handle all the traffic you want, but the particular program that does a particular job, it wasn't designed for that. The point is, they're supposed to test for this stuff. This is what's really creepy. The fact that everyone on the planet knew that there was going to be a vaccine and there would be a huge rush to get it. Why wasn't this all in place and ready to go a month ago, for example? Because everybody was waiting for this. And that's a question got to be answered. I was talking to Representative Bill Driscoll, who's going to be having hearings on this next Thursday, and that's going to be one of the key questions that everybody's going to ask. If this were something that nobody knew was coming, we'd all just shrug. It's like, you know, ice storms in Texas or something kind of thing. But this is something they
right, which we've
coming.
Seen that too. Well, hey, you said they got this oversight hearings, as you mentioned, coming up. So maybe we'll get some more answers then. I will say, Hiawatha, you're dating us. In our day, back at the Globe, when we worked together, this used to be hard, but they shouldn't be that hard anymore.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to bring in some callers who have some questions. George is in Randolph. George, what was your experience today?
Okay, I started at about 8:15. And I finally gave up around 12:15. And I was actually accepted in three different sites, and I got bumped off right at the end because they said there was no available slots after I'd finished the whole application process.
George, I'm sorry to hear that. Alfred is in Providence. I want to get you. Provincetown, I should say. Obviously not Providence. You'd be in a different state. But in Provincetown, Alfred, what was your experience today?
Yeah, it was like I tried. I mean, I know the chairman of the Barnstable County Commission. I know two state senators. They've given me, you know, websites to use. Is there a magic website? Like, I have friends who just happened to call the Orleans in the CVS in Orleans 2 weeks ago, and the people there told them, yeah, and they made an appointment through the pharmacy. I mean, can you do things like that? But everybody's saying you need to go through this thing, and they went down and registered, and in fact, next week they're getting their booster. So my question is, what website is best to use?
Well, I mean,
Alfred,
I'm
it's
not
a good question.
Expert.
Go ahead, Hiawatha. Do you have any advice for him?
You can contact individual sites that have it, and they may very well be able to hook you up. It doesn't absolutely have to go through this site. In fact, one of the issues here in Massachusetts, as compared to other states like Vermont or West Virginia, where they've actually got one central place where you go. Precisely what's going on is that in Massachusetts, we don't have one central place where you can go. And you can go out there freelancing, looking around and finding places that might have the vaccine that you otherwise wouldn't know about. That does happen.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Just hold on 1 second, Angus, because I want to hear a little bit from Tim Rowe at CIC Health, because your firm, Tim, is operating the mass vaccination sites at Gillette Stadium and Fenway Park. So, Tim Rowe, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
It's great to talk to you. And for folks who may not see what the acronym is, it's the Cambridge Innovation Center. You're known for logistics and for making tech work, Tim. So what was your reaction today to seeing the state's website down?
Yeah, I think that what everyone's been saying here is correct. For whatever reason, they were caught off guard. Hiawatha, I can't disagree with you that this appears to be something that perhaps could have been tested by the company that runs the software. The software, as I understand it, is, you know, one of the few that was actually designed to register for people to get vaccines before COVID. So it seemed like a reasonable place to turn, I think, for the state to address this need. I guess they just never anticipated, you know, 2 million people wanting a flu vaccine all at once.
Yeah, but
so,
how
Tim,
many
what
people
are you
live in
telling people? Well, right, exactly. You feel like it's a math problem you might be able to solve. Tim, what guidance are you giving to people who are trying to book appointments at your vaccination sites?
Yeah, so I heard one of the commenters mention that there are sites where you can kind of go direct and register. At the state-sponsored sites like Gillette and Fenway Park that CIC Health manages, we're actually mandated to use this software, and there is no other software. So if you there's no other way to register for vaccines at the mass vaccination sites. We're all in the same boat. We're incredibly frustrated. I heard the governor say he was very angry about the situation. I do want people to know that this disrupted booking future appointments, this did not disrupt people actually getting vaccines. The ones that are happening today and tomorrow were scheduled last week. And those are all flowing as normal. Nobody has missed their vaccine as a result of this.
Well, that's a good point, Tim. I'm glad you mentioned that. And to that end, I want to go to Amanda, who's calling from Danvers. Because, Amanda, I understand that you were just at a vaccine clinic. How did that go for
you?
Yeah,
I just had it 20 minutes ago. Everything's fine over there. Everybody's very nice. I didn't book it today, but I did use that website that the woman who was on maternity leave created, macovidvaccines.com, and it worked perfectly. It took me under 10 minutes.
Got bad.
Well, good, Amanda. I'm glad to hear it.
It's working now.
There you go. But it worked. But it worked earlier. And to Tim's point, Amanda was able to get it done today. So that is an important distinction. The people who had previously registered were able to still get their vaccines today. But there is some trouble with future. So Tim Rowe, last thing while I have you, are you getting any guidance as one of the state's partners from the state about when everything will be back up and running?
Yeah, I actually just talked to our technical director. What he said is they're all heads down, you know, with that third-party provider trying to fix the problem. So we don't know any more than anyone else does. I will say that I've been watching it closely over the course of the day, and I'm not sure if this is going to be good news or bad news for anyone. But the Gillette sites and the Fenway sites did come live. The sites were still full of errors and so forth, but those appointments were booked today. I watched the numbers go down from, you know, full to empty in a very short period of time. So while the site clearly had issues today and I had lots and lots of emails and calls saying, hey, is this you guys? No, it's not us. But those appointments for next week are now booked, as I understand it, at least at the largest mass vac sites.
All right. Well, some bit of good news there. Tim Rowe, co-founder of CIC Health. Thanks for dropping in with us. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right. Hiawatha Bray, I sort of cut you off there, but
I was just going to say that heard about Olivia Adams' famous site, the woman who built the alternative site for finding appointments when you couldn't find them on the state website. Her access went down, too. So if you went to her site, you still couldn't find any of these state-run sites because she got her information from their website. So when their website went down, her website went down. On the other hand, I've just gone to her website, and Gillette and Fenway Park currently have a couple of slots up. Apparently, they're slowly getting the system back up. And on her site, they're listed as having a couple of appointments available, but for how long, who knows?
I will point out, if you're wondering why you're not hearing from the state in this conversation, we did invite the Department of Public Health to join this conversation, and the agency declined. Alma did not decline, however. Alma is in Somerville, and she is chiming in. Alma, what was your experience today?
I tried logging in and through the state website. She had to set up an account, and one of the questions they asked her was, what time zone are you in? I'm like, what? There's one time zone in Massachusetts. What does it matter? In the meantime, I was on the phone. I got put on hold for 8 minutes. 15 minutes later, they said the wait time is 14 minutes. I put up for a callback. We're still waiting for a callback. I'm wondering, why didn't the state contact Harvard or MIT to see if they could help us set up a website? Because it's purely dumb luck, and it's very frustrating. And I'm thinking, who's in charge here? I mean, it's just been a phenomenal mess in a state that's supposed to be really smart. My friend in Alabama was able to get a shot set up very easily last week with no trouble. And I'm wondering, what is going on in this state?
Alma, thanks for the ring. We can hear the frustration in your voice. And yeah, with all due respect to Alabama, Hiawatha, I mean, she makes a good point because this is Massachusetts. We are a healthcare hub. We are a technology hub. And so as Alma's saying, why didn't we call up Harvard or MIT? I mean, there is something particularly frustrating, I think, for our residents, right?
No question about it. I mean, I've written about how West Virginia picked up the phone and called a company in Massachusetts called Everbridge. And in 2 weeks, they built them a system for doing this. This is something that Massachusetts companies do. Today I talked to Akamai out in Cambridge. They have an entire package of software that they created just for dealing with COVID vaccine, and they're starting to market it to other state and local governments. So we, right here in Massachusetts, have companies that are making solutions for this, and I don't know why we're not using them. I just don't know.
All right. Tom is in Truro. Tom, how did it go for you today?
Hello.
Hey there, Tom. You're on. What was your experience trying to get an appointment today?
Well, mine was like the first callers. I started at 8 and I gave up at 12. What I found is that Gillette, there would be one availability on one day and two availabilities on another. Oh, boy. And you go through after about 15 tries, I would be able to put in the first page of data. Then there's a second page of data, and then I'd be knocked out with an error. And I'm going, number one, why do you have to fill out two pages of data, detailed data, insurance, and blah, 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 just to make the appointment? You should be able to streamline it to make the appointment first and then get a follow-up where you give them your insurance data or your Social Security number and all that stuff. As long as you qualify for the age group or the occupation group, you ought to be able to register, then give them the data. That makes registration very simple, and then you can give them whatever information they need at your leisure and their leisure. Number two,
sure.
I
got
don't
it, Tom. Thank you. I'm going to stop you there
open.
And just take it back because I want to get some thoughts from Angus Chen on this. Because Angus, you can hear the frustration from Tom there, and even though he didn't get through, I think he makes a good point that he was, by my math, there he was online for like 4 hours straight, refreshing and trying right. over and over again, and that's a tough experience. But if you have, not everybody could even do that, right? I mean, this sort of goes back to some of the inequality issues we've been discussing when it comes to the vaccine rollout. If you were able to sit by your computer and refresh and refresh, maybe you got through. But if you were on your way out the door this morning to your shift as a grocery store clerk, you needed the website to work immediately, the one time, right? And if it didn't work for you, then you didn't have the luxury of sitting at your computer and refreshing over and over.
Yeah, absolutely, Callum. I mean, this kind of gets back to a lot of the equity issues that have plagued this pandemic since the start. I mean, if you are someone who works an essential job, someone who needs that job to survive and pay your bills, you don't really, you can't just sit by and hope that the website is going to work sometime for you in the next 4 hours. You know, you need it to work for you, like in the hour before you leave for your shift. And the fact that it wasn't working this morning means those people didn't get the opportunity to sign up. And others did, you know, others who had a little bit more privilege, others who had, you know, maybe a better internet connection were able to get those appointments. And I do think that's really unfortunate.
It's a great point. And while we have just a couple of minutes left, I do want to squeeze in one more caller. Peter is in Newberry. Peter, what was your experience today?
Well, I was on for about from 7:55 a.m. until about noontime, and it was incredibly frustrating. I mean, this is a system that is completely upside down. I just don't understand. We have, Medicare has a database of every single person over the age of 65. Why are we not just using that to allocate slots to people? Why aren't we doing a system where we say, you know, everybody whose last name begins with A through D, you know, call in this week, next week it's E through L, et cetera, just to, because it's a totally anticipatable problem, but it's upside down. We should be using the data that we have, the databases of patients that we have in order to get people vaccinated.
Sure. Peter, I'm going to take it back from you there because we're a little bit tight on time. But Hiawatha, I just want to get your closing thought on that point, because I think what Peter's getting at there is he says, oh, we got this Medicare data that we could use. But what we see is this sort of decentralized rollout. I'm not sure how much local, state, and federal programs are coordinating with each other, right? Medicare is a federal program. These local rollouts may not know what that data is.
They probably don't. And that's an even more – but, of course, that raises whole entirely different issues about, you know, how you safely combine people's personal medical information. And that raises all kinds of privacy issues. And so layering that on top of the situation might conceivably make the matter even more complicated if they figure out how to do this without possibly jeopardizing patient privacy. Because some people argue that we should keep the virus, or the vaccine, as an isolated situation where the data on that is kept separate from other personal medical information so as to protect user privacy. And you could do that in a safe and efficient way. It's possible. They just haven't done it.
Sure. Well, that's Hiawatha Bray, technology columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks, as always, for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Also with us was WBUR's own Angus Chen. Thanks, Angus.
Thanks, Callum. Good to be here.
The pandemic has taken a heavy toll on students and their families, and that's especially true at the state's community colleges. Enrollment plummeted last fall to a 23-year low, and the steepest drop was among Black and Latinx students. Joining us to discuss what that means for the Commonwealth is Carlos Santiago, Massachusetts Commissioner of Higher Education. Commissioner Santiago, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Callum.
So just how hard has the pandemic hit the state's 15 community colleges?
It's hit them quite hard. And let me just go a little bit through the history. About a little less than a year ago, we started to see signs that this was going to occur as a form called the FAFSA form, which is a federal application really for financial aid and for loans. And that's a leading indicator of whether a student is going to college. It's unlikely, you know, that they would go to college if they don't fill out the form. And we saw significant declines when the compared to previous years when the COVID hit. And that was, we then looked at the enrollment data in October. We did some things to try to minimize that by extending deadlines, things of that sort. But by October, we knew the numbers were looking bad. And again, you had mentioned a 20 plus year, the biggest decline in over 20 years. And we just finished breaking down the numbers this past month by race and ethnicity, and they were even worse than what we saw in October for all students. Latinx students and African American students, the decline in enrollment at our community colleges, where two-thirds of those students go to school, declined by about a third. That's a huge decline, and I think what makes that quite problematic for Massachusetts is that these are the two groups, particularly Latinx students, that are actually growing in number and have been growing in number, given the overall population decline of high school to college age students. So it's troubling. We're very concerned. We're trying to ameliorate the situation. And, you know, in the conversation I had with Commissioner Riley, the elementary and secondary school commissioner, our big question was, is this a one-year decline? Are we looking at not only last year's seniors, but now this year's seniors? What about juniors? Maybe this is all a 2 or 3
and years. And what was the answer? I hope it was a good
answer. Well, the answer is we better find out pretty quick. And we have gotten guidance counselors on the phone, and a lot of people have been making calls to do get qualitative survey data. We still don't have the sort of end answer to that question, but we know it's deep. We also know, you know, data has indicated to us that if a student, you know, graduates from high school, plans to go to college, but doesn't go to college, that reduces over their lifetime the prospects of even going to college at all. So this could be, you know, I said it publicly, and I'm real concerned, this could be a lost generation, and Massachusetts cannot afford to lose more students given the overall decline in its population in a real knowledge-based economy.
Well, let me just ask you then. I mean, what is the broader implication then for our state economy? I mean, we all hope this is a one-off and not a whole lost generation, as you say. But if we see our college students or our potential college students, as the case may be, students who could go but are not able to because they're feeling squeezed right now, if they continue to struggle, what does that mean for the Commonwealth's economy?
Well, you know, we've seen the demographic decline for a number of years now. So we've been prepared for it. We've been directing programs to help these students. We know that the majority of students of color are located in our gateway cities and 50 high schools. So we have got a sense, and we've introduced a number of programs to try to remedy the situation over time. Early college programs, dual enrollment programs. A lot of different things have been put into place to make sure that students are more successful than ever. I would remind folks, we took a closer look before COVID hit at, what are the barriers that students face, particularly students of color. And clearly affordability is one of them. But what we have found is that it's not the only indicator. And I often say that affordability for students is a necessary condition for student success, but it's not sufficient. And the sufficiency part of it is really around support services for these students. Many of them are first generation college going students. They come from families where no one else has gone to college, has very little information. I talked about the FAFSA form. I mean, that's a tough document to fill out. Let me tell you, I've done it for three daughters. It's a tough document to fill out. And if you've never had experience with college and what it means and how to fill that complete that form, you're at a disadvantage. And what we have found is a lot of students, particularly students of color, have been at a disadvantage in terms of going to college and succeeding in college.
And that may be exacerbated during the pandemic, because if they're not at school in person, they may not have that, sort of hand-holding from a guidance counselor to help them through that. I do want to ask you about one bright spot in the data, though, Commissioner, when it comes to enrollment figures. First-year Black and Latinx enrollment in the UMass system actually did rise slightly last fall, which is in contrast to that 30%+ drop-off at community colleges that you mentioned earlier. So why did UMass fare so much better, and what can we learn from that success?
Yeah, well, I think there are fewer of them in the UMass system. There are fewer students of color in our UMass system, and that's one of the reasons why it didn't fall off as much. And the students generally have somewhat higher incomes, and those are going to community colleges or even our state universities. So part of it is a reflection of differences in income levels. But one of the things that we're seeing that I am particularly troubled by is that, we have seen over the last few years more what we call basic needs not being met for college students. We've seen more homelessness than ever before. We've seen food insecurity. All of our public institutions have food pantries. We have now we're seeing more evidence of mental health issues among students, and it's not unusual in given the environment in which we're living and the impact of COVID-19 on families, on communities, on work as well. So this is sort of a different world, I have a hard time imagining how a student that is homeless or hungry can really focus on being successful in school. I know they do. The fascinating thing is
one of the challenges that I know that you brought up with our Max Larkin in the story for WBUR earlier this week was that some of those support services at community colleges may be the first things to go because the schools are trying, understandably, to preserve instruction. But absolutely, those support services are important not only for the students, but frankly for the bottom line, right? Because they help students stay in school and keep paying tuition.
That's absolutely right. And what we're finding is, something we call case management, where students actually get direct support from a counselor of some type. And the issues that they deal with are, deal directly with school issues, with homework issues, with assignment issues, but also go beyond that, with many of our, I think all of our institutions have these emergency funds. Where if a student gets a flat tire on the way to work, they may not have the money to replace that tire, and that may impact their likelihood of staying in school as well. We know that in these communities, a lot of the majority of our students in our community colleges are part-time students. They have been ravaged by the economic decline and many of the service jobs which many of them held that have disappeared. over the last year. So it's there's a lot of angst. There's a lot of hurt in these communities, and we're going to do our best to get those students back on track and back into school.
Well, to that end, Commissioner, in the moment we have left, let me just ask you about some of the resources and efforts that your department is working on right now. I understand one, for example, is developing a summer college prep bridge program for high school mm-hmm. graduates who want to go to college. They may not have had the most robust education during the pandemic. So what can you tell us about that and any other things that you want to underscore?
Sure. Those programs like early college, like summer bridge programs are really effective. If a student that has had no experience with college, that has no one in the family that has been through college, can get a taste of college in an early college program and do well in those programs or a bridge program in the summer, the likelihood is they're going to go to college. They're going to go to college and they will succeed in college. And all the data suggests that as well. So we have to be more closely aligned with K-12. We have to be able to help those students make that transition from a high school to a college environment for them really to succeed.
All right. That's Carlos Santiago. He is the state's commissioner of higher education. Commissioner Santiago, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Callum. Always appreciated.
This Black History Month, we've been shining a light on various aspects of Black life in Boston. We've remembered pioneers like former State Representative Doris Bunty and architect Donald Stull, and examined how communities hit hardest by the pandemic are dealing with inequality and hesitation in the vaccine rollout. Today, we're speaking with three Black professionals about their experiences in the Boston business world and their efforts to diversify it. We're joined by Terry Williams. She's the president and chief operating officer of Boston-based One United Bank, which is the country's largest Black-owned bank. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm well. We're glad to have you. And also with us is Kristen Ransom. She's co-owner of Include Innovation and Include Web Design. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. And finally, we have Sheena Collier, founder of Boston Wild Black Networking Group and the Collier Connection. Hello, Sheena.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, too. Terry, I want to come back and start with you and ask, how and why did you get into the banking field, which we know is historically dominated by white guys?
Yes, it is. Actually, I'm surprised I'm in the banking field. I worked at American Express. I was very interested in financial services. But was really hesitant about the conservative nature of banking. So I went to American Express, but ultimately ended up coming to Boston and buying what used to be the Boston Bank of Commerce, which is a Black-owned community bank, because I believe that there was a way for us to use community banks in our community to help our community build wealth. And I'm glad I did.
And Kristen, same question to you, because I think some of the same things about sort of the old boys clubbiness of banking could also be said about the tech sector. So how and why did you get into technology?
Honestly, very similar to Terry. I found, there definitely is an old boys club. There is a feeling of otherness when you're involved. But I think my love for design and development and just building things from a really young age, I used to take things apart and put them back together like it was nobody's business. And once someone told me, you know what, you should be an engineer, I realized that there's so much good that you can do if you can get past being the first or the only in the room.
Sheena, I want to ask you about being Boston Wild Black, because you're in the business, I think, of connecting people in a way that overcomes some of the barriers that we just heard Kristen and Terry describe. So why was that your calling?
Yes, that's a good way to put it. It is my calling, actually. Initially I had started the Collier Connection as a way to work with companies and organizations throughout Greater Boston to really show them how to build community and networks with people of color, whether it's their customers, their employees, suppliers of color. And after doing that, as well as a lot of my own events around the city for over a decade, really just wanted to create this safe, inclusive space for Black people, professionals, entrepreneurs, students, to really learn together how to navigate the landscapes of Boston, particularly socially, politically, and the economic landscape. And I thought it was really important Just because, you know, Boston can be and has this reputation of being unwelcoming or not as friendly to everyone. And I think particularly for people of color, and in my case, Black people, really just creating a point of access to information, to resources, to opportunities, so that people really feel like they belong and want to live and work in the city.
Well, as a native Massachusetts son, I will cop to that reputation. You are right. And I take it that maybe comes, it sounds like there's maybe some personal experience there, Sheena. So what has your experience been like coming to Boston and, mm-hmm. and, you know, just living your own identity in this city?
Yeah, I'm from Albany, New York. So, you know, New York has a somewhat similar reputation, but I moved here from Atlanta, Georgia, and was there for 4 years for college. So definitely had gotten used to the Southern hospitality. And when I moved up here, 17 years ago to Harvard for graduate school. And, you know, all the perceptions I had of Boston from my quick visits growing up, going to Quincy Market to the many movies that are out about Boston, I felt like initially they were confirmed, though I was in Cambridge and Bostonians were always like, you're not in Boston. But, you know, just being in the area took me a long time to really feel like it was a space where I belonged. One, because I didn't see a lot of retail, a lot of restaurants, a lot of spaces that reflected my culture and in the music and things that I liked. And also, you know, couldn't figure out kind of how to really plug into the city. Like, how do I connect with other people outside of my industry? And that really drove my first couple of years here, even neighborhood-wise. I wasn't sure where to live. I moved to Harvard and Comm Ave in Austin because that's where a realtor told me to move. And so it wasn't really until I started to do my own exploring, both through my job and in other ways, to really dig deeper into where the communities of color were here. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, Boston is actually very rich with communities of color, and something I think that we should see much more as an asset, which I think it's seen as a deficit.
But what an interesting experience, as you described, being sort of steered to certain locations as a newcomer, not really knowing and having to seek it out yourself. And also, Terry, I want to pick up that thread from Sheena about sort of being the only one in certain spaces. I'm wondering if there are things that you feel that you have to think about as a Black woman that your non-Black colleagues do not in your business world.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. And, you know, my experience is actually similar to Sheena, and came here for grad school, went to Harvard Business School, and really had to work to connect to the Black community in a way that I don't think that my counterparts in sort of in banking have to. And, you know, one of the things that I would say that a lot of, I think, people don't know is that Boston is a majority minority city. I mean, people just don't have that impression of Boston. There are a lot of us here. There are a lot of Black folks here. And there are also a lot of organizations to connect to. You know, I always say to students, you know, join the NAACP, you know, join, you know, the Urban League. You know, there are all these different organizations. The Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. There's all these organizations that can connect you to the Black community. And you really do have to do that if you're Black in Boston, because if you're downtown, you feel like there's no Black people, you know? Whereas if you go to Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, even, you know, Sheena mentioned Cambridge, areas of Cambridge, and that's all you see are Black people. So, you know, it's sort of that dichotomy, that, you know, racial wealth gap, that, you know, where segregation in terms of where we live, I mean, all those things play a part. And so you really do have to really work hard. I mean, even joining a church, you know, I'm a member of Myrtle Baptist Church in Newton. It's a Black church. That's where I brought my kids to grow up. So we definitely have to really spend more time focusing on connecting to the Black community in Boston.
Kristen, I want to ask you about something that you mentioned in a pre-show conversation with our producer, Paris Alston, that really stood out to me. You were describing the experience of being an engineering student at Tufts and how many of your classmates, particularly your white classmates, could just focus on making cool things. And you sort of carried this extra weight. I think you described it as having a kind of bleeding heart syndrome. And I wondered if you could expand on that.
Absolutely. I think James Baldwin said it really well. He said to be Black and conscious in America is to be in a constant state of rage, you know? And I think seeing constant representations of especially Black people in this country where we're being killed by police or we're constantly being underrepresented or underfunded or, you know, undersupported, it lies very heavy on your mind. And as a student, it's very easy for you to say, you know what, I have to pass my classes, so I just have to ignore that. But I honestly think my empathy and my intention has made me as an engineer and also me as a business owner within Include Web Design even more successful. You know, our main goal within Include is to eliminate the digital divide. And one of the best things that I can say is that having this intention on how can I use my experience as a Black woman to use technology for inclusion as opposed to exclusion or for social impact and social movements as opposed to discrimination and bias is a really powerful, powerful thing.
You know, Sheena, what I hear from Kristen there, and you're maybe picking up on the same thing, is a powerful networking argument for diversity, because Kristen is making the point that, you know, she really brings something extra to the table based mm-hmm. on her life experiences right. and that companies should value that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just like the comment I made around us really celebrating the diversity, seeing the diversity of Boston as an asset. You know, it's the same in these corporate spaces. And I think because of the way this stuff has been talked about for years, you know, a lot of it because of the history of this country, because of systemic racism has been seen as a mandate for people. And so sometimes they approach diversity, inclusion, equity as a task, you know, as something they have to do, as something that's going to add additional work to them, rather than really seeing this as a way to create more richness and frankly, more financial bottom line success in companies. And I think the more that we can tie those things together and really show that you're not really doing anything different. Something I've said to my white counterparts at times when talking about a lot of initiatives is I really think that we overcomplicate things. And I think that, you know, you can think about what you would want for yourself at work or what you would want for yourself in your community and just do that. That's the same thing people of color want. That's the same thing Black people want. There may be some differences in delivery because of cultural differences, but we really want and need the same things to be successful in these spaces.
It sounds like the golden rule there, right? I mean, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Exactly.
I want to ask you, though, Sheena, because something you said before the show really stood out to me as well. And as you were describing systemic racism a moment ago, I was thinking of something that was maybe not at the top of the list, but you mm-hmm. you mentioned before the program the ban in our state on happy hour, which I usually mm-hmm. do not include in systemic trouble. But the point was that, you know, happy hour is a time for networking. And if we yeah. had that here in a non-pandemic world, obviously, this mm-hmm. might be another opportunity for Black people and everyone, of course, to do some more networking. Yeah. And it might actually, there's a racial equity argument for happy hour.
Yeah, the reason I mentioned it, you know, I'm often talking with people about, you know, one, is Boston fun, you know, and is it somewhere that really attracts people? And I think sometimes the conversation stops there because people think it's about like, oh, people want to dance more, they want to drink more. But it's really about creating some economic activity. And we know that particularly as generations, when you get to millennials or younger, people are choosing where they live and then choosing where they work. And so if you don't have places that really draw people in and you know, if you have a certain level of education and connections and other things at this point, you could probably find a good job in most places. So most cities. And so it's really about where do I want to create a life? Where do I feel like I'll have a great social life? I'll be able to have a family if I want, et cetera. And so I was the happy hour piece, you know, with those types of laws on the books, you know, I was making the point that Boston has a hard time competing with places that just have more of a vibrancy and just places where people just feel like there's more of a space to enjoy themselves.
And be authentic, and if we, you.
Yeah, be you, show up in spaces as yourself and really, you know, for me at this point in my career, and this is a privilege, I'm not solely driven about by where I want to work or what I want to do. It's like, where do I want to live?
Terry, let me come back to you, because one thing I've been wondering about during this work from home period for those of us who are fortunate enough to be able to work from home is whether one of the silver linings, although many people do miss being in the office, is that perhaps folks are experiencing fewer of the microaggressions that they had to put up with around the office. Terry, I wonder if you've run into any of that or you've heard any anecdotes about that from coworkers?
Actually, I think it's been harder for our community. For one, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of us don't have the ability to work from home. And for those that do, there isn't the same opportunities to get to know the team as you would have if you were in the office. So you really do have to work harder at it. And then there's this whole thing about, you know, Zoom and the microaggressions of Zoom. I'm just going to talk specifically for Black women, you know, sort of, you know, how do you dress? How do you look? What's your background? You know, how do you, I mean, there's a lot there that, that causes some stress that wouldn't, you know, that is particular to our community. So, I don't know. I think that there's some benefits, of course, from working from home. But I think from a Black community's perspective, there's also some downsides to it.
Kristen, we have just a few moments left, but did I hear you wanting to chime in on that one?
Well, just a little bit. I think Terry definitely hit the nail on the head. But honestly, another aspect is as a parent. You know, I feel like it is very interesting being a woman, especially in the technical sphere, being there physically without your children. You're able to kind of focus exactly on what you're trying to say. And it seems like even though everyone is working, or at least most people in the technical sphere are working from home, there is a lot of judgment being passed when you have your kids in the background or where you're trying to multitask. It almost feels like you have to do twice the work again, just to, again, prove that you are, you know, just as capable, just as focused on what you're doing. Mm.
That's Kristen Ransom, co-owner of Include Innovation and Include Web Design. I'm so sorry that we have to leave the conversation there. It's been terrific, but thank you to all of you. We were also joined by Sheena Collier, founder of the membership network Boston While Black and the Collier Connection. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Terry Williams, president and COO of Boston-based One United Bank. Terry, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.